Session number 8735, Dr. Reginald Saxton, Part 1.
Could I ask you something about your background, Dr. Saxton? Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in Cape Town, South Africa, and my father was a lecturer in botany at the university there. From we left there when I was still an infant, about 2 years old, and my father was appointed then to an professorial job in botany again at the Gujarat College in Ahmedabad, India, at a time when Gandhi, in fact, was imprisoned there for having broken the law by distilling seawater and making salt. So my early years were brought up in the British Raj in India, which I think I had a fairly happy life, except when I was sent off to school, the boarding school. And
was that in England?
The earlier schools were actually in India, but schools for British people in the hill of India, where it was the climate was better and so on, because Ahmedabad is a pretty hot, sticky climate. Then, from when I reached the age of about 8, then I was sent to school in England, to a prep school, boarding school, and used to spend my summer holidays with friends of my parents and their families, that I was separated from my parents for several years until my father retired from India early on account of on health grounds and came back to England. Well, so I went on from this prep school, and the family was then at home, to a British public school, Repton, where I came under the influence of the sort of upper class British ideologies and so on. From it was during my time there then that I began to sort of think more on, you might say, to question philosophies which were then current in the society in which I lived and the people amongst whom I moved and so on. And it must be as the that very bad economic crisis developed towards 1929, somewhere about that sort of time. Oh, and the miners' strike, of course, 26, I think. And there was a general strike too. I forget just which year that was. Anyway, all these things began to worry me a bit, and I was rather horrified by hearing one of the prefects in the house in the school in which I resided commenting on the difficulties, economic difficulties then, and political difficulties and so on, which existed, when he said, well, there's only one thing, he said, to do with the poor, he said, and that is to crush their faces into the mud under your heel, he said. I thought, good gracious, that's a horrible thing to say, you know. And this, I suppose I was already rather objecting to the sort of regime in the school. You had fagging and beatings, and beatings which were permitted of elder boys beating the younger boys, and this sort of thing. And it was partly my own fault that I came in for a certain amount of this, because I was not a very observant person, and I, in some ways I seem to fail to get all the proper ideas which the young and enthusiastic boys ought to notice, such as strange customs at school and ways in which words were changed to have special significance, and the whole history of the school didn't terribly interest me. Anyway, so for this reason I was questioned again and again about the things that boys at Ripton School ought to know. I used to have sort of examinations after lights were out in the bedroom, and if I failed to come up to scratch with all the right answers, then I was beaten on the bare bottom with toothbrushes by the more senior boys in the bedroom, the small dormitories we had, sort of three, four, half a dozen people, that sort of size. And so that I began to thoroughly dislike this school and all the ideas that seemed to go with it. So by the time I left school, I was rebelling against quite a lot of ideas, but only in my head, so to speak. And I was a bit concerned about religion too, and how that seemed somehow to be mixed up with this business of establishment, as you call it nowadays. That wasn't the word we used in that sense then. But I was brought up as Christian by my mother. My father was a rationalist, I think he called himself. I suppose he was an atheist. He didn't call himself that, but he didn't care about church going and things of that sort, but my mother did. And now they used to take us off to church quite frequently, and we tolerated it. We weren't too convinced. Nevertheless, I felt, well, I've got to go through with this and get right about this business of religion. And so I followed on and tried very hard to sort of understand and believe and all the rest of it. And I went through and I to being confirmed into the church, and went to classes and I suppose theology or whatever you might say, for the headmaster of the school and the housemaster of my house. And I must say, on one occasion I was invited out to some kind of party by a master I thought knew I had to go to these classes anyway, or was going, and I missed one of the classes, and the housemaster was very cross with me. He said, "You put your stomach before your God," he said. And I was a bit hurt about that, because I thought, you know, he knew that I was doing this. But nevertheless, maybe there was a bit of truth in it. I was beginning to have my doubts about religion, having heard all this talk. And anyway, I went through and I was confirmed in the end, and we came to the last day of school at Ripton when I was leaving finally. Having risen to no great heights, I don't think I ever became a prefect at Ripton, even in the house, as far as I recollect. May have had some junior job of that sort, but very little of that sort of disciplinary advancement. It came to the last day, and we assembled in chapel, and we had a special talk or sermon from the headmaster of the school, Dr. Fisher, who later became Archbishop of Canterbury, was our headmaster. I think he had 9 sons and no daughters. Very interesting genetically. We called him the Beau, and they were the Bowlets. Now, Dr. Fisher then, our headmaster, said, "Well, now, you've been educated to be good Christians," he said, "and to go regularly to church," he said, "and what I feel is this, that you've really got to be good Christians and go regularly to church, but if you're not, you might just as well pack it in altogether." Or, he didn't use those words, but this is what it amounted to. And I took that as my cue, and I said, right, I've finished with religion. And from then on, I considered myself to be an atheist. So I went on to Cambridge. At Cambridge, I was studying for TRAPOS in physics, chemistry and physiology. Now, if we go back a long way to my prep school days, I had really felt I'd like to be a doctor around about the age of 10 to 12. I thought, this is a wonderful sort of profession, you know, caring profession, where you can really help people and this sort of thing. You know. I still feel that way, mind you. And so, nevertheless, well, I was still at that prep school, reaching about the age of 12. Had a few friends I used to talk to at school about our ambitions, our hopes for the future, and so on. And I said, you know, I told him about my hopes in this direction, and he said, "You want to be a doctor?" He said, "Do you know what doctors have got to do?" I said, "No, what?" He said, "They've got to cut out people's gizzards." I said, "Really?" It sounded a terrible thing to have to do, to cut out people's gizzards. So I was totally put off by this, and I gave up all thoughts of being a doctor then until I reached Cambridge. And at Cambridge, I was doing subjects which were also done by medical students. And most of my friends were medical students, and they were studying physiology too. As well as anatomy and other subjects. And I thought, well, where the devil am I getting to? Just with natural science, TRAPOS, there's not much future in that. And after all, what is a gizzard and why shouldn't one cut it out, you know? So that, bit by bit, I thought, I ought to be studying medicine. And after my first year at Cambridge, I switched to medical studies. I had to work very hard to catch up. I would spend my vacations going up to St. Mary's Hospital, where I did my first dissections, and worked in the long vac up at Cambridge itself, which is a 6 weeks course you could take to catch up in biology and things like that. And so I gradually caught up, and eventually I took my preliminary medical examinations, went on to Barts. Now, when I was at Cambridge then, I was there in the era of those notorious people like Philby and co. It was about the same time they were there. And had I been interested in at that stage and had time to spend on political interests, if I had a mind in that direction and if I'd had the time, I have a sort of feeling I would have been very much mixed up with the politics of those people who were later to become spies and Soviet agents and heaven knows what. Perhaps it was lucky for me, I was far too preoccupied with my academic work and catching up on my studies and the necessity of a very hard slog in that direction to have any time for outside activities. I participated in sports, I played football and tennis and things like that, and really went to theatres or whatever, but I had no time really. I never went to these debates and debating societies and political meetings and so on. They never crossed my path, or I never crossed their path. I just had not the time. All my evenings, practically speaking, I had to be studying. So that, there but for the grace of God go I, thinking of these others who, people of greater intellectual capacity than myself, of course, landed up in the unfortunate political and social context or whatever that they did. So at any rate, I was at that stage an individual who was questioning social values and political values, but not going any further than that at that stage. So
29 to 32, you're at Cambridge.
Yes, and so and 32 or 33, I was from at Barts onwards. 32, I suppose I moved over in the I don't know what time of year, but I suppose it would have been the term at Cambridge begins at Oxford in October. So I'd finished in the summer at Cambridge in 32, so presumably in the autumn or winter of 32 I must have gone on to Barts. Where again I stayed till 32 to 35 at Barts, following up, because I'd taken my preliminary medical training at Cambridge, the non-clinical part, and went to Barts for the clinical part. This is a very common practice, which my friends were doing too, you see, whom I had numerous college friends by that time who were all medicos. No, not all, but most of them. And most of them were going on to Barts. And so, well, I thought I might as well go too if I can. And that time the difficulties of getting higher education for those who could afford to pay, just, which is my position, or my father's position, were not so great as they are today. And the competition was less, the standards of education were less, the facilities perhaps of cramming were better. And to get into Cambridge alone, I mean, I had to pass this little go, as it was called, right? And so I had to learn a language I was always been trying to get away from. I love languages, actually, but dead languages. I didn't like Latin. But I had to have Latin to get into Cambridge. So for about the third time, I prepped the school, I'd had a bit of Latin there. My public school, I'd had a bit of Latin. And all the time I was trying to get away from Latin. And yet there it was, I had to cram it all again to get into Cambridge. And so I learned a set book by heart with the translation. Brushed up some of the Latin grammar and stuff, and I managed to get through the little go on that basis, and then I dropped it flat for the last time, realising later that it was quite useful, actually, in medicine. So many of the words are combinations of Latin and Greek, quite a stupid combination sometimes, but still, one gets used to them and uses them. And so Latin is helpful, and Greek too. I know they studied Greek. Anyway, let's pass on to Barts then. Well, Barts, I had some of the same friends who'd been at Cambridge with me, and I made new friends, of course, too. But what influenced me as much as anything, again, was the social and political ideas which were fermenting in my mind. And at home then, I lived in Reading. My father, I think I told you, had come back to England, and he'd got a job as a lecturer in botany at Reading. It wasn't a university then, it was attached to London University, and it was a college, or I think they called it that. Anyway, in the botany department he became a lecturer, and then he was disappointed. He'd applied to become a professor when the vacancy occurred in his particular faculty, and he was overlooked, and he took this very much to heart and resigned. However, he still had to need to earn a living, and so he took on a one-year sort of locum job back in Well, it started, you might say, in Cape Town when someone had a year's leave to go away, and he had a temporary position there. So he went off to South Africa. Family was a bit disturbed, especially my mother, and he never came back until his old age, or very long time after, and he deserted my mother, and there was a divorce and so on. So I was left with my mother at that stage. This was about the time I was still at Cambridge that all that domestic upheaval happened. So by the time I got to Barts Hospital then, my father was settled in South Africa, and my mother was alone and in not very good financial circumstances. And she started taking in lodgers. We had a very nice maid who really became a companion to my mother, a sort of general factotum and cook and everything else. She was a lovely person who stayed with my mother. This was the second appointment. She started as a housemaid at the age of 16, and then she lost her job there when she had to leave it to go into hospital for an operation. She lost her job. My mother, the second employer she had was my mother, and she lived with her for the rest of their joint lives, or at least until they were too ill to do any more, you know, toward the end of their working lives at any rate. And so my mother took in lodgers, and between these two people, were very fond of each other, the mother and this cook maid, housekeeper, who, as I say, ended up as a companion, they ran this lodging house. My mother was a very sociable person and a great conversationalist in her way. She could talk to anyone about anything, whether she knew about it or not. And she was very good at acting as a sort of guest housekeeper or whatever. And so she was looking around for people to come and be lodgers. And she took up, and we had the contact with the university through my father's job there. And so she was sent university students as lodgers. And so in this house, this home of mine, there lived my two sisters, myself, my mother, and the cook. It was quite a big three-story building, and two or three university students most of the time. Now these students then were an interesting lot, because many of them were misfits who couldn't stay in the normal university hostels for one reason or another. Not all of them were exceptional, but one in particular was a very stimulating, mentally stimulating fellow, and because he was what was termed a bookworm, and he read and he read and he studied, and he was a pale, thin fellow, rather below natural stature. He looked as though he'd sort of been never seen the sunlight. You know, he was perfectly healthy, really, but he just didn't. He wasn't the outdoor type. The student subject, I think, was history. I'm not sure what his actual subject was, but he certainly read very widely into social history and things like that. So, and because he was a bookworm, because he didn't have to play sports, and because he sort of looked ascetic sort of type, if you might say, and generally didn't go in for the sort of rumbustious activities of the young students in the hostel, they bullied him. They teased him incessantly, and life was impossible and study was impossible for him, and so he was boarded out. And so he came to live as a lodger in my mother's home with us there. Well, there we would be At mealtimes, for instance, my two sisters and myself and two lodgers as a rule, my mother and all the rest, that sort of, and we talk about all sorts of things, but this young man was very interested in the sort of economics and things of that sort, how society was organized in that direction. You sit down there, puss. And he used to bring home fast books, and he got us interested in these things too, my sister and myself, particularly my elder sister and myself, were more and more concerned. I think there was a lot in what he was saying, and we ourselves had our own criticisms of things, though we couldn't see any real way out of it. At least I couldn't speak for myself. And then he came across, by some casual way, he came across a theory. I think it was in a leaflet or booklet or something of the sort. He heard of this theory put forward by a certain Major Douglas, known as social credit. And he said, well, it sounds a remarkably good idea. He didn't use those sort of words, but this is what he said, in effect. Here we have a lot of industries going idle, a lot of unemployed people, and people can't afford to buy the goods they produce. Otherwise, if they could afford it, they'd do so, and why can't they afford it? And surely if they had enough money in their pockets, everything would be fine. And Major Douglas's theory of social credit amounted to, in fact, working out how much extra money people would need in order to buy the products of industry, if the industry was working at its full capacity, by giving an increment to everyone's wage each year, which would only equal the capacity of industry to work at full pressure and not more, so as to cause the inflation, as he thought there was a surplus somewhere which people were not getting, because industry was producing more each year, therefore there should be more wages each year. And marvellous idea. This sounded a very good idea to us, so we started reading more and more about Major Douglas's theories and ideas, getting books by him, and even going to London to meetings about his ideas. That's my elder sister and this student, Mr. Booth, and myself.